previously broadcast program.
Thank you all for joining us again, all four of you. We don't know how many people are watching. This is another episode of Politics in the Time of Corona. I say name every time. Welcome to Politics in the Time of Corona. My name is Bassam Haddad, and with me is Noura Aliqat, and this is our fifth or sixth episode. And we are joined by Dean Ahmed Dallal from Georgetown in Doha, Qatar. We are very excited to have you, Ahmed. We're going to conduct this in English, and welcome to this podcast.
Very good to be with you always, Noura Bassam.
Thank you. Ahmed, if we could just start off with you telling us how you are coping with this at the personal level with the family and how you're dealing with this in Doha, this pandemic.
Yani, of course, the pandemic is quite scary. This is, no one would have even imagined something like this in our wildest dreams, I think. I haven't. You know, I've grew up during the Civil War. I've been through some tough time, but this is, the scale of this is really overwhelming and humbling in many major ways. You know, we're still in the beginning, and the actual fallout and the effects of this will become clearer with the passage of time. We've moved into remote work and instructional continuity and online instruction, you know, at the beginning of earlier in March. And soon after, we started preparing for remote work, and most of us moved. And as of last week, I also started working from home. Yani, we prepared all the setup for working from home. So I'm now confined, except, of course, for grocery shopping. That's the only reason to go out once in a while. I'm with the family. Anyway, it's a relief. And I don't worry as much about bringing something home to the family, and they're also more, they feel more comfortable with me with them. I go into the room. I actually work much more now than I did. I always worked a lot, but if you can imagine, I even work more now than I did when I wasn't at home. And you know, in a way, we're busy making sure that we're operational. So the sort of fixation, if you will, on the operations sometimes keep you distracted. When I finish working, I follow up, I read on what's happening elsewhere in the world. I try to read on what's happening on the science front, you know, what we know about the virus. And I have nightmares, obviously, of course, you know, every night. I mean, you know. But anyway, we're fortunate that we have the ability, we have the, you know, the technical ability to continue working. So the confinement, at least there is a sense of purpose that keeps us distracted. But the scale of this moment is huge, is massive, and I think the psychological effects on all of us are going to become more and more. I mean, of course, in some places they're immediately visible, but as this unfolds, they will become more and more visible. I only hope that once this nightmare is behind us, people will not forget what we're living through.
Before we go on, before I yield the floor to Noura, can you tell us a little bit about the view from Qatar regarding the basics? I know that there have been about almost 700 cases with only one death, I mean, only in quotation marks, and things of that sort. We don't know very much about how the broader situation is in terms of preparedness, in terms of dealing with the pandemic. Can you give us just an overview?
Look, I don't think anyone was prepared for this pandemic, and people are learning how to deal with it. And the country has been proactive, very proactive in taking measures. Actually, the decision to go online is a national decision. We didn't make it. We made it before our main campus made that decision, before they went online. We made it here in Qatar before, because there were national directives to this effect. Schools were closed, and gradually there is no complete lockdown. There are occasionally areas where there is a high concentration of cases, which need to be tested and disinfected. They're sealed and they're disinfected, and eventually they lift the lock on these areas. But there are restrictions on all public gatherings. All shops were closed. The only stores which are open now are supermarkets and pharmacies, and delivery services. So there is a, you know, gradually with the passage of time, especially this last week, since the beginning of last week, there has been much more enforcement of the prohibition of public gatherings of all sorts, including prayers, including funerals and weddings, including even house parties and house gatherings, including a high concentration of passengers and cars and buses and so on. And the in parallel with that, as you said, there are close to 700 cases. The last count last night, there is a count every night. Last night, I think it was 693 or something like this. And there are about 20,000 people who have been tested. So the testing is I think this suggests that there aren't enough test kits. The testing is very deliberate and not everyone who needs to be tested, they're checked first, and that if there is a reason to test them, they test them, otherwise they don't. There are multiple quarantines, quarters that have been established everywhere for everyone in Qatar, for the workers, for migrant labor, for the workers, you know, the workforce, for all segments of the population. For example, we have dorms at Qatar Foundation, and there are two buildings within the dorms. Some students who could go back home and wanted to go back home left. But that's for us, for the Georgetown population. I don't know about others. I think it's similar numbers for other campuses. Only a third of our students chose to go back to their home for a variety of reasons, including in many cases, some of our students are from countries which are not equipped to deal with this situation, which are neither equipped technologically. They don't have the bandwidth, they don't have the reliable network connectivity to continue education online, and they're not equipped health-wise. So many of our students chose to stay in Qatar. The dorms, two buildings in the female dorm and male dorm were emptied and prepared in case there are cases. They're prepared to quarantine individuals in case they need to. So far, there has been no cases in QF, but there were many major measures that were taken. Also, food is delivered, prepackaged food is delivered to the students now. There is, around the hour, healthcare, there are nurses, and there is a clinic in QF, and nurses in the dorms too, and two male and two female nurses at any one time. So that, you know, they're very proactive about the measures on the national level. And, you know, we've been acting pretty much at least in part in response to that, and also in part in coordination with main campus, with the developments of main campus. You want me to tell you more?
I just became curious about, so you're telling us the view from the campus itself. I'm wondering about the national response. In your assessment, it's great that they've put a ban on gatherings and prayers and house parties. But in terms of the testing and the hospital capacity, what does that look like? Is Qatar well prepared in your assessment? How are people responding to these calls? Has there been, do you see some sort of collective response on the ground? Was it set up to execute well?
Of course, we will only know once we are tested to the extreme. But so far, everything suggests that there are reliable measures and professional measures that are put in place. At the very beginning, there were tests conducted at the airport. You know, in a sense, the blockade is a blessing, because there is only one port of entry and there is at least some measure of control over the flow of people into the country. There were strict measures that were introduced at the airport. Right now, very few people can travel. It's not complete. Qatar is still flying. And by the way, they're flying cargo flights, but they're also involved in shipping medical equipment and support to countries that are in bad need, including Iran. I mean, they've sent some medical equipment to Iran, and they're sending also to other countries elsewhere. So the cargo is playing a role in this. Anyway, from early on, they started controlling the entry to the country, and they were testing the passengers. They were asking them where they came from and so on and so forth. As you know, things moved very quickly. So very quickly they banned flights to a certain number of countries, and then they increased that number, and now it's pretty much everywhere except for bringing back citizens. A couple of days ago, they were Bahraini citizens. They were not able because all the airport in Bahrain was closed. They were not able to go back to their home students. They brought them to Qatar, and they hosted them until Bahrain provided a flight to bring them back to Bahrain. So they're working systematically on this front, and they started building capacity. They emptied, I don't know the exact number, but there is a very large number of hotels that have been emptied to serve as needed as quarantines. There was a city for workers that was under construction, and the government sped up the construction of this whole city and designated as a quarantine location in case it needs to be used for workers. So there is and then hospitals, of course, most of the hospitals are no longer receiving regular cases, unless they're urgent. And not all hospitals, some hospitals, so it depends. They've introduced, telemedicine services in all of these, in all of the hospitals at the national level. And they've designated some hospitals, emptied the hospitals and designated them completely for the treatment of the virus, of people who are infected. So there are designated hospitals. They're building more facilities also to accommodate more, as they treat. And so far, they've been able to accommodate everyone.
Are they anticipating a surge as well? You said they're building more hospitals. Are they anticipating a surge in the coming weeks?
They're acting, I think it's the only way to act. They're acting as if there will be a surge. And there is a national committee, a high-level national committee, and there is strict implementation. About a week or 10 days ago, they released 10 citizens who were under quarantine, and they released them. They didn't have the symptoms, but they were in contact with people who had the symptoms, and they asked them to self-quarantine for 14 days. They didn't observe the quarantine, so they published their names and they persecuted them.
Legally? And criminal charges? Civil charges? How did they prosecute? How did they prosecute them under criminal?
The government decided to persecute them for violating the requirement of self quarantine, and they released their names to the public, sort of public shaming them as well, and actually spoke about them. The spokesperson for the emergency committee, which has a press conference, which is far more reliable and it inspires confidence much more than the press conferences we're seeing on your end of the world. They release the figures, they share the information and so on a daily basis. And they said this is a risk for the whole community, and this cannot be tolerated. So that, the country is acting very, very seriously. I can tell you, we have, by policy, since we moved to telework, work from home, people have the option of working from their homes here in Qatar or from their homes elsewhere. We have only two staff members who chose to fly back, and for very specific individual personal reasons. We have a handful of faculty members, less than a handful of faculty members who chose to fly to their quote-unquote countries, their other countries of origin, because this is their country of residence. In all cases, because their families, their spouses and children were in these countries, and they didn't want to be away from them, quite understandably, in case of an emergency. The flight itself was risky, but they couldn't, they had to be with their families and enjoy their families, take care of them. But there are faculty, for example, who are here on, for a year. We have lots of exchange faculty from the U.S. And this would, it would have made perfect sense for them to go back home to the U.S. because they don't need to fly back. And the whole question of, you know, the uncertainty about the ability to fly back, they so far have chosen to stay here.
Ahmed, if you can tell us from your vantage point in Doha, Qatar, what does the regional scene look like in comparison to Doha? I'm assuming that you would know a lot more than all of us here. What is going on around Doha, Emirates, UAE, Kuwait, Bahrain, much more so than Saudi Arabia, but also Saudi Arabia? Is it a comparable situation in terms of the...
I think in all of these countries, there are very strict measures that are now taken in all of these countries, you know, in terms of, you know, stopping flights, closing the airports, or at least reducing the number of flights, in terms of lockdown and shelter in place and closing schools and so on and so forth. So there are comparable measures, although not all countries started at the same time. You know, there was a reluctance in the beginning. Qatar started very early with all of these public measures, you know, and introduced steps almost incrementally by the day. And you could see that there is a committee that is weighing the odds and making decisions on a daily basis. It was a little bit more delayed than other places, but right now most of these countries have. I mean, Saudi Arabia was the last to come forth, and you know, although they were taking measures, but they were saying there are no cases in Saudi Arabia. Of course, there are quite a few now. Now the cases are published. So there was a slight delay in announcing the cases, but at this point, and you know, in a way, we're fortunate that, you know, the countries have the ability to mobilize and take these measures. It's a privilege to be able to, I mean, you know, to be able to take measures like this. Now, that said, a couple of days ago, there were laws that were passed in UAE, which say that, you know, employers have multiple options, including laying off some of their workers or having partial work or laying off a portion of the work and so on and so forth. Qatar has passed laws saying that everyone, so all workers, even if they're quarantined, will receive full supply, medical as well as, you know, all everything they need for survival. And by law, they have to receive their full salaries for the foreseeable future. And, you know, whether they're quarantined, whether they're working or not, so no salaries will be stopped for everyone across the board, for all of the workers. And again, we're fortunate that the country can do something like this because it's very costly to do something of this sort. But Qatar has been very clear about this. Of course, you know, this will take, you know, this will take a toll. I mean, it's a costly decision, but it's been published, it's been repeated almost on a daily basis in these press conferences that I tell you about. The measures are taken across the board for everyone. And in fact, in terms of the implementation of these measures, the workforce is compliant, I mean, you know, by and large. The distances from families who are finding it difficult for understandable reasons to confine themselves, and there is quite a lot of effort to ensure that these measures are applied across the board. And you know, it doesn't take a genius to understand that you cannot solve a problem of this scale for a portion of the population. You know, you either introduce measures that apply to everyone, or everyone is going to pay. I mean, the whole world is paying for, and there are still people who don't see it this way, you know, but it's quite commonsensical. It takes a little bit of common sense to understand that this is it's a collective vulnerability. There is no, you know, it affects us all in the same way, and all of the other barriers drop. Of course, the fact that there are populations which are extremely vulnerable and others, you know, who could afford to be protected. I mean, that fissure, that gap is now becoming, you know, I mean, the crisis reveals all of these major social ills global at the global level. But at the same time, I think it doesn't take a lot of thinking to realize that the solution has to be global. Otherwise, there will be no solution.
I think, you know, what you're highlighting is something that's still, you know, the left is definitely cognizant of how class status, you know, and exacerbates vulnerability, close proximity, poor hygiene, lack of access to medical care, lack of access to health insurance. All of these things are laid bare about, you know, the possibility of even survival, the ability to quarantine, right? Even the ability to quarantine has made that very, very obvious for a lot of people. And yet for some, it's still, like, as you're saying, this idea that it won't be possible that just a few of us will survive, right? That this, you know, the idea that was floated around in the UK and in the US, that somehow only the strongest would survive.
Yes.
Which was a very thinly veiled, right? Racist and classist trope before they realized actually that they could not be immune. They could not be immune.
You know, the way I see it, of course, the most obvious form of vulnerability is people who cannot afford to not work, because they will start, because they don't have the option, because they will not have access to medical care if they get infected, because of everything. They can't eat, they can't feed their families. And this is where, so there is a lot of fixation on the economy as opposed to seeing, you know, the priority is society, it's people, it's not the economy. I mean, what good is an economy when people die en masse and when there's such an impact on the population? So, you know, if you could address this issue, the issue of this fundamental vulnerability, the people who cannot afford to be sick, who cannot afford not to go to work, they get sick and they hide it because otherwise it's certain death for them and their families. If you could address this, and you can only address it at the national level, then you would have eliminated at least a significant, it doesn't mean that you've erased inequalities or whatever, but you would have erased one of the biggest vulnerabilities in the current situation. That's one thing. The other group of people, you know, we have one of our faculty members published a small piece on the future of democracy after COVID. And he said, you know, and I find what he wrote very interesting. He said that, you know, it's interesting how easy it's been for some to get into this isolation mode. You know, we're all talking about, you know, how difficult it is to be in this. But what he was observing is that for significant segments of the population, it was automatic. Yeah, let's go home and shelter ourselves and hide. And in a sense, that is a, you know, to my mind, this is the extreme thinking about these, about our fate and our destiny in extreme individualistic ways, and not recognizing that our fates are so intertwined and interconnected. And of course, you know, this is happening at the highest levels of authority, you know, at the highest levels of power, this type of approach to the problem. So anyway, that's a different story. That's another. But there is another segment of the population, the young people who insisted on going to the beaches, and, you know, people who work in startups and high-tech startups and whatever, who think they're invincible, who say, you know, why should we exercise social distancing and whatever? We're all young. We're all in our 20s and 30s, and so we're not vulnerable. We're not susceptible. So why don't we go and work? Again, they're not thinking that they're part of a social fabric, and whatever they do will affect everyone else. It is, in a sense, you know, another face of the same coin. There are those who cannot afford not to go to work because they will starve. They will not have access to any of the services that they will need to survive. So it's you know, they'd rather take the risks and work. And there are those who would go to work because they think they're in their little cocoon, they're in their little bubble, and they're not part of society.
As a takeaway from what you said earlier, I think, you know, and some folks have actually been studying this, those, you know, we're in knowledge production in different fields, but for folks in public health who have addressed class as a public health, a primary public health issue, right? So often we think about it as, you know, just, you know, the medical and the science and not the societal, and yet this is emphasizing how public health is a matter of class, And it, again, it's a policy lesson we're not necessarily learning on our side of the world, but it's really at least, you know, it's in the places where you expect less have been quite impressive, as Qatar has and as other governments.
With the limited resources that are available here, it's really common sense. It's how you deploy whatever resources you have. I mean, you know, not everyone has. Of course, again, we're privileged. We're fortunate to have access to. I mean, we're fortunate, for example, in the little institution where I work, that we have, for one thing, we have, first of all, conducive laws and measures taken by the government that enable us to operate as we do, that have been proactive and pushed us in a way to take these measures, which are, you know, so far, alhamdulillah, I'm sure, you know, no community will not be touched by this, will not be affected. But so far, we haven't had cases, and, you know, and we're very fortunate for that. But more than that, we're able to operate. We're able to continue operating, in a, you know, on a different level, on a different scale, but we have the infrastructure, we have the bandwidth, we have the technology, we have the resources to enable us to continue to operate, you know, and our little institution and many other institutions are doing, you know, to some extent, similar things. So we are fortunate, no doubt.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, it's not, you know, whether the resources are big or small, it's the will and it's the collective measures that are taken by the by any country. It's putting your mind. I mean, this is, you know, again, this is, as I said earlier at the beginning, Noura, this is humbling. We really haven't seen anything like this. I mean, no matter how many disasters, and we come from a region which is plagued by disasters, but this is on a different scale.
No, this is literally the substance of, you know, sci-fi literature I've written. read. I don't write sci-fi. Yeah.
Before we wrap up, Ahmed, because we're getting to the limit, I will ask
this.
We're
past.
We're past. I mean, I didn't think that we were going to. Yeah, we're over 26 minutes. You know, there's talk of, you know, the end of the world. There's talk of all sorts of, you know, catastrophic potentials. But I must reveal to you the real reason why we're calling, or at least why I wanted to speak with you personally. Of course, you're a friend, you're a colleague. We've collaborated on so many substantive projects. But the real reason I wanted to speak with you is to find out from your vantage point in Doha if this is going to affect the World Cup. Of course, I'm joking, but do you know anything about that?
He's like half joking.
Okay.
All the predictions is it'll take a year to 18 months at the latest, and hopefully they will speed it up. You wonder where all the science is, but anyway, all the predictions. So yeah, it will have an effect on the World Cup to some extent. It will delay things, of course, but it's still possible. I don't think anyone is there, Bassam. I mean, you know, you're asking this as a joke, but the reality is, I mean, you know,
we can't really
predict too much. I mean, you know, we want to survive this. Of course, it's not the end of the world, but you know, at this pace, it is possible to now start imagining the end of the world. You know, there will be other disasters and other nations.
Worse than canceling the World Cup?
After the World Cup.
Ahmed, thank you so much for being with us and giving us your time. I know that there's a lot going on, and you took time out of your busy schedule at home. If Noura would like to say anything, please go ahead. Otherwise,
thank you, Ahmed. It was great to see you and to get your perspective both at the institutional level as dean of a university as well as from the Gulf where you're speaking to us from.
And hopefully,
always great to talk to you. But honestly, I mean, you know, the primary reason that I said yes to this is to see you. Let's see how you're doing.
I know. I couldn't say this on live podcast.
Why not?
صحيح ليش لا. شكرا كثير أحمد.
يا هلا.
سلام.
Take care.
سلام.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. We're very lucky today. We're joined by two guests to discuss the situation and what politics in the time of Corona looks like from Tehran. In two geographies, we have Alex Shems, who is based in Tehran, to tell us about what it looks like there, which has been a ground zero in the course of the expansion of the coronavirus, as well as Huda Kotabi, who is based in Chicago and has been taking a primary lead in challenging the sanctions regime on Iran, which has been a debilitating and crippling part of the medical infrastructure within Iran during these trying times. So welcome to you both. We want to start off just by asking how you all are doing, how your families are, how you're feeling.
Well, I guess maybe I can go first. I'm doing okay. My family here is doing okay. I think, you know, in Iran, we've been dealing with this for about 5 weeks or so. So on one hand, we've gotten used to certain aspects of it. On the other hand, it's been very surprising watching it spread in the U.S. and Europe in the last few weeks. So I've gotten used to being worried for my family's safety here in Iran, but it's a very new worry for me to be very afraid for my family in the U.S. and their safety. But generally, I'm doing okay. I've gotten more and more used to staying at home for long periods of time. How about you, Hoda?
Things have definitely been intense. I don't think anybody like predicted the ways that the United States would be responding to this, both domestically and internationally. So it's been pretty chaotic and very difficult. I mean, I'm worried for my family in Iran. So I think right now it's just it feels like heightened and escalated. And I call and check in. Family members, especially people who are on the front lines. And to cope, I have learned sitar, and Alex and I have a duet that we're working on.
A duet?
We might ask you to perform that as part of the program.
Very early stages.
Well, I'm glad that you're coping in that way. Alex, you touched on a really important point, which is that we begin by being really overly concerned with Iran, and now obviously you have family in the United States you're concerned about because the numbers in the U.S. have now hit 85,000, thereby surpassing all other countries in the number of COVID cases. And so why don't you, can you take us a little bit into the interior of what it looks like from your vantage point in Tehran and what it's felt like?
Sure. Well, so basically starting about 5-6 weeks ago is when the first alarm bell started going off here in Iran. The first measures that were taken were schools and universities were closed about 5 weeks ago. And then subsequently, a lot of public venues were closed as well. So theaters, cinemas, gyms, basically any kind of large public entertainment or leisure facility. And so from 5 weeks ago, basically, you have a huge percentage of the population that has been staying at home, confined to home, whether as students or as people who are providing childcare. And at that time, you had the first shift in the situation in terms of like a lot of classes, they went on TV. So all classes are taught through TV. And then university classes have moved kind of online, which is what we're seeing happening other places as well. And that's kind of when there was a lot of fear, I think, at that point, especially too, because there wasn't a lot of information available about what was happening, and it wasn't clear how serious it was and how people were going to respond. And so the first cases we had were in Qom, about 2 hours south of Tehran, and then from there they kind of spread across the country and then spread, across the borders as well into other countries nearby. It was kind of unclear to what extent things were going to be shut down, and there was conflicting messages. And I think one of the reasons for that was also because it costs a lot of money to shut things down. And I think that's something that people are just kind of waking up to in the U.S. and Europe after a few days or a few weeks of shutdown. But all of the overtime salaries that have to be paid for police, for people who are working on the clock, at the same time that medical expenses are kind of suddenly exploding, they're was an expectation that there was going to be a total shutdown, and then it really never came. And it's very clear that part of it is due to the fact that the government doesn't have the money to pay for the shutdown. And confining millions of people to their homes would deprive incomes at exactly the time that basically Iran's economy has gone into a total meltdown. After it's been about 2 years since Trump reimposed U.S. sanctions, and the result of that was immediate. 2 years ago, basically the Iranian currency became worth about one third of what it was I think it happened over the course of about a week. It lost two-thirds of its value. People's life savings went up in smoke. And part of the sanctions were also limiting Iran's ability to sell oil and other commodities abroad. And so overnight, almost, you had a huge portion of the government's budget wiped out. And we had seen the effects of this over the last 2 years in cuts to social security programs and cuts to social services. Just in November, there were major protests against an attempt to increase the price of gasoline, which was linked to the strain of sanctions. And at this moment, it's very clear that the government is not in a position to take care of a lot of the issues that need to be taken care of, despite the fact that Iran actually does have a very strong healthcare system and it has a very well-developed health infrastructure. And this is one of the things over the last few days, there's been rumors that there's going to be a shutdown of inner city travel, which would be extremely helpful, I think, in certain ways in terms of limiting the spread of the virus to rural areas that have less developed health infrastructure, because that's something we've seen as well in Iran. Like, the first week, for example, many people weren't necessarily taking seriously the social distancing measures. And we had people going on vacation to the Caspian Sea, which is like a beach area. And which it's very interesting to watch what's happening in the US, because we're seeing that a very similar series of events happens where the first wave of physical distancing is promoted and then people immediately try and go on vacation. And what happened in Iran is that the health system of those beach regions was basically overwhelmed the next week by a massive explosion in coronavirus cases among people who were working with tourists or were, you know, were working in the service industry. And I'm afraid that we might see something similar to that in the US in the coming days.
Alex, let me interrupt you briefly before we switch over, because you did start to give us a glimpse of the effect of the sanctions regime. But before we switch to that, can you give our listeners a little bit more of, so 5 to 6 weeks ago, the cases break out. There isn't a complete imposition of a closure. We see a spike in corona cases in some areas like the Caspian Sea. But what about the rest of the country? If people are not, in fact, if there is not, in fact, some sort of a mandated shutdown, then how are these cases being contained? Is it more through tracking and containment? Is it through, because, you know, about on March 12th, we saw aerial images emerge of mass graves in Iran. I mean, I'm not sure if that's verifiable. So you're giving us a picture that people have not responded necessarily with extreme urgency. And yet we're also not getting this idea that it's getting worse. So can you clarify that for us?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think it's been much more gradual than what's happened in the U.S. I think the first week or two, when it really started spreading in Qom, which is where the photos of those graves were being found, right? It spread under the radar because it took at least a week or two for tests to kind of be rolled out. And then by that time, as far as I understand, the source of the arrival was Chinese seminary students who were studying in Qom. And by the time I think people became aware of the outbreak, it had really spread throughout the seminary, and it had spread into government offices as well, because we had a number of major clerics who came down with it and passed away, as well as government officials who within the first week or two were getting it very quickly. And I think part of this is because they're, you know, connected to the public, but I think Qom is basically one of the worst affected areas. And the fact that it hit Qom, I think, also relates to the fact that Qom is a very transnational city. There are students there from all over. The first cases in Iraq was a student who was in Qom at that time. And it's also a pilgrimage hub. So you had a lot of people moving from Qom to countries around it, to Pakistan, to India, to Afghanistan, and also across the country, people who were visiting Qom. And so basically, because it was already, a religious tourism hotspot, there was the fact that it spread in that place meant that it spread very quickly, especially in Tehran and cities quite close to Qom, like Isfahan. And it's definitely spread gradually. I think one of the good things about the school closures was that it meant that a lot of younger people who are asymptomatic, who have been shown to be major spreaders in other countries because they don't appear to be sick, they don't feel sick, and they're pretty sure they're not sick, were basically taken out of circulation very early on, right? These are people who, young, I mean, children were staying at home, they weren't infecting classmates, and I think one of the major route of transmission was actually taken out. Now, the other side of that, right, is that closing schools was an easy way for the government to address the issue without having to spend a lot of money. Because what happens when you close schools is you basically shift the childcare burden onto families instead of having to pay you know, a lot of the costs that would be associated with keeping those schools running. And so, and I think that shows how much the economic logic is forcing these decisions, and it's making it very difficult to take decisions, to take further decisions that might come with a heavy cost at this moment. Because the fear is that they won't be able to pay salaries very soon, for example, for people who are working in ministries. Now, it spread, like I said, kind of over the last few weeks. We reached over the last week a kind of, I mean, I think everyone's seen those graphs of the curves. There's been a kind of leveling where it's become a much slower spread than it was before. There's a fear that in the next week it's going to jump again because we had the New Year holiday last week. And even though the statistics I've seen are that 50% less people travel than they did last year, because normally this is a year when everything is closed for 2 weeks. People go to visit their families and their towns and villages where they're originally from, and it's the biggest time of travel in the year for Iranians, the beginning of spring. And it basically declined by 50%, but the other 50% still went. And so the fear is that that's going to lead to a second wave of spreading, despite the kind of leveling out that we've seen recently. And however, that being said, in the last day, it has been announced that all inner-city travel is blocked and that all non-essential stores will be closed. So we're finally seeing the rollout of some of those measures, which, to speculate, I believe is linked to an unfreezing of Iranian money, Iranian central bank money that's being held outside of the country that the U.S. has frozen. It appears that there is a direct relation between the ability to implement measures and Iranian money that, due to sanctions, has been blocked from Iranian government access.
So I guess that's a great transition to you, Huda, to tell us. That's interesting, Alex, that you're telling us that money is actually being freed up in order to be used by the Iranian government, at the same time that the State Department announced yesterday that it was going to tighten sanctions on Iran. Huda, you have been following that closely and also helping to lead a campaign to lift these sanctions for at least 120 days to ease the medical crisis, if not to keep it, indefinitely lifted. Can you tell us about what that campaign looks like and why the U.S. at this critical moment would actually tighten sanctions almost without international repercussion?
I mean, when has the United States done anything with international repercussion? and could we expect anything more from a Trump regime? I think that it's sad, but it's not shocking that during a time of like a profound, just like a global epidemic, Trump will just worsen sanctions and actually worsen the situation in Iran when the world is actually asking on Trump and Pompeo and Mnuchin to lift sanctions. So I think right now, that this is like a sort of a major emergency. And researchers are actually predicting that if sanctions aren't lifted by May, that 3.5 million Iranians will lose their lives due to COVID. And so that's just not a number that we're willing to risk or bet on. So we're trying to do everything that we can. It's a large coalition of community organizers, activists, and progressive organizations from across the country really working on trying to put pressure on the Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who usually is behind the scenes, but bringing him to light and really letting people know that this is the person pulling the strings, and we have to make sure that he knows that that there's a lot of people who are very angry about what's happening, and they're not going to let it go, and they're going to hold them accountable to that. And so we've been working on just a variety of tactics, which is also unprecedented in a way for a global pandemic to be happening. So we're also trying to figure out how to organize in a time of COVID and what that looks like, while also like making sure that this isn't lost in like the larger noise. For us, it's really important that we shed light that the United States isn't just, we're not asking for aid. We're asking for the United States to release the funds that Iran already has in order to be able to support and deal with COVID that's happening domestically. I think there's a lot of like misinformation about like, why are you trying to get the United States to pay or like provide aid when they don't even have enough medical supplies domestically? And I think that it's really important that like that the request is not for aid. The request is just to get America's boots off of the necks of Iranians so they can deal with COVID responses. And I think that's something that's really important for us is also that we understand that this is a global, like, it's a moment that we can actually tie global, like, liberation and global health in a way that's very intimate. Because now we can see that, you know, here in the United States, everyone is asking everybody to stay indoors, do their part, and flatten the curve. But America has a responsibility in flattening the global curve. And if anything, we can realize that if the healthcare system in Iran is not able to take care of Iranian citizens, and Iranians are dying in COVID continues to spread in Iran, that's going to come back and hurt Americans here too. So I think it's a very important time to realize now more than ever that our health and our safety and our lives literally are deeply and globally connected and interdependent on each other. I think it's really important for us to be able to also make sure that people here realize that it's not just like some far thing happening in another world that they don't know about or isn't affecting them, but it actually is in their healthcare. And we're seeing the United States completely be a failure of leadership time after time again here in the United States. They're also sort of mapping this out and replicating this on a global scale. As you mentioned, just yesterday, they added additional sanctions on specific individuals and entities in Iran. In the middle of countries such as China, Pakistan, even the UK calling on the United States to lift sanctions. The United Nations is also called for global ceasefire, and sanctions are a form of warfare in the ways in which they're enacted against Iran. And this is the time that like America is acting with complete impunity, per usual, but we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that it's not happening again.
Alex, if I may ask a question about the domestic situation in Iran and the discourse, especially the government discourse, and perhaps even more broadly, how is this and to what extent is this situation being politicized in Iran, especially vis-a-vis the United States? We've read reports that we're rejecting help by the United States because at one point a major leader suggested that this might be a Trojan horse sort of help that would actually exacerbate. I mean, is this being politicized, or are we seeing this from our vantage point here in Washington, but domestically it's actually just a primary concern with the spread of the virus and containing it?
Yeah, no, I've seen those statements, and I think I think it's been politicized to a certain level in the discourse of leaders as they attempt to figure out how to respond to what's happening and to make sense of the spread of a virus that I think for people around the world, it's kind of unimaginable. It's very hard to wrap your head around what's happening. And I think, however, it's important to highlight the fact that regardless of what people might be saying in terms of coming up with theories about where it's coming from, the fact of the matter is that the Iranian healthcare system is completely overwhelmed. There are people, the kind of stuff that we're just starting to see in the U.S. has been happening in Iran for weeks now, right? There are not enough beds. There is not enough medical equipment. In a very short period of time, especially given that in other countries, it hit Iran before it hit other countries. And so that was a key time when Iran needed to be importing medical equipment from other countries. And because of U.S. sanctions, it can't do that. And I think that's one thing. There's somewhat of a misunderstanding that we're asking for, that people demanding an end to sanctions are asking for a medical exemption. It's not about a medical exemption. It's about the fact that sanctions have forced Iran to be delinked from the international financial system. So it can't buy anything from anyone. It has to pay in kind when it buys things. And as a result, it has a very limited ability to work with companies outside of Iran. It has a very limited ability, even, for example, to buy face masks from a company in Germany or anywhere, right? Places that you might not think are connected to U.S. sanctions. And over the last few weeks, Iran has been desperately in need of that. and has been in desperately in need of the ability to buy medical equipment, to buy ventilators from outside of Iran. And instead of the U.S. Allowing or creating an exemption so that the sanctions will not be enforced during this period of time, or lifting them altogether to relieve the larger economic and political burden that they've imposed on the people of Iran for no good reason, right? Because I think it's important to remember that Trump violated the Iran deal, which was working and which both Iran and the U.S. have been abiding by up until that point. Basically, what you have is a situation in which Iran has lost extremely valuable time, and then certain statements, certain events are being blown completely out of proportion, right? And so there is this this saying that we don't want U.S. aid. Now, part of the idea of saying we don't want U.S. aid is we want the U.S. to give us exactly what is our due. The U.S. has frozen more than $100 billion Iranian dollars in bank accounts in the United States, the majority of which is Iranian money that was, it's the profits from Iranian oil that was sold outside of Iran that, due to the imposition of sanctions, gets frozen back in U.S. banks. And it's $100 billion that belongs to Iran. No one's disputing that. But the United States is saying, we won't allow it to be sent to you, right? And so part of the making a point, I think, about saying to the United States, well, we don't want your aid, is that we don't want your handouts. We don't want breadcrumbs off the table when you have basically imposed these crippling, debilitating sanctions on our country that have ruined the lives of 80 million people, and which are now forced, putting us into a situation where we're weeks behind responding to a health crisis, and yet we can't even, and we have to make everything for ourselves, whereas other countries are able to kind of cooperate or consider, the ability even to ship medical supplies from one country to another, from one place to another. Iran is completely on its own because of U.S. sanctions.
Alex, let me follow up on that. And what Bassam, I think, was getting at also, which is internally among Iranians, how has this, it sounds like what it might have done is actually consolidated the Iranian people in opposition to the sanctions regimes in a way that might have muted critique of the Iranian regime itself.
Let me be completely honest. Over the last 4 months, the Iranian people have been hit by blow after blow after blow. It's been like getting punched in the face constantly from every single side. After 2 years in which we've had these blows as well. Like I said, imagine that an entire country 2 years ago, two-thirds of their life savings went up in smoke overnight, right? And I think 20% of the population has gone into poverty just in the last 2 years because of the implementation of U.S. sanctions. The economy was growing 5 to 7%, I believe, before the imposition of sanctions. We contracted 10% last year, right? There's been an incredible blow that has severely undermine people's living standards in an extremely short period of time. And on top of that, you have austerity measures by a government that has been trying to deal with this, with these massive cuts to its income, right? So the protests in November that were violently repressed were an attempt to implement an austerity measure. Following that, right, in January, it's hard to remember all this because it feels like time is moving very quickly, especially, I think, for Iranians, because the thing they were worried about 2 months ago was that the U.S. was about to bomb Iran and invade it. Right, we were on the cusp of a war in which the United States was bombing, assassinated an Iranian general in a foreign country. And the fear and the threat was all of a sudden that we have no idea what's going to happen. And I think that was a moment when, for example, because the U.S. attacked Iran, a lot of people who the last month or 2 months before were coming to terms with what was one of the most brutal repressions of internal dissent we've ever seen in Iran's history, suddenly diverted their attention to the fact that there was a possibility that all of this was going to be destroyed by the United States, right? And so if there was a moment of kind of gathering around the flag to defend the country from an outsider who clearly has no one's interests at mind, right, and who will do much worse to the Iranian people than any of their own leaders could, right? I think, and I think the reference of Iraq, for example, is very much on people's minds of this is what could happen to you, no matter what they say about them caring about you, the United States caring about you. It's very clear that they don't, right? And it's only a month and a half after that suddenly we have the coronavirus. And one more event that happens, you forget how many events it happens, right, is that an Iranian passenger plane is downed by the people who claim that they're protecting the Iranian people. right? We have event after event after event that leaves people, I think, bewildered. I think it leaves them in fear. And I think as a result, at this particular moment, it's very hard to imagine what kind of politics is possible, because not only have people been hit over the head over and over and over again in the last few months and in the last few years, they're also faced with the fact that this disease prevents them from gathering. It's a disease that in any way possible prevents people from seeing each other, from being connected, from talking to each other. And imagine that 3 months ago, the internet was shut down for a week, and the only way that anyone was able to figure out what was happening was by talking to people, and suddenly we're forbidden from talking to each other. And so I think for that reason, it's a little bit hard for me to think about the political possibilities. I think you're right in a certain sense. There is a fear of sanctions. There is a fear of what's coming that lends people to not, let's say, critically oppose things that they see around them that are wrong. But I don't. I think at this point, that's not on people's minds. There's a sense of complete exhaustion and of deep, deep fear about the present and about the future.
So, thank you. That was incredibly comprehensive, and it was so good to take us back, to put this into perspective, that in these 3 short months, the world has been rocked, but Iranians in particular have been rocked by these series of events, which is a great reality check, right? So thank you for that. And so I want to just shift over to Huda as we wrap up. If you can tell us a little bit more about how the international community has responded, defied the U.S., and how folks who are responsible for the sanctions regime in the United States, how we can be more involved in the work that you're doing.
Definitely, yeah. And I also just want to echo one thing that Alex said also, is that Iranians right now are just like between a rock and a hard place. And I think it's really difficult that there's just like, it's put in this place between like a regime that also has consistently failed them, and then the United States that uses that against them constantly. So it's really difficult. And I think that we've also seen, like you said, like the population kind of going like back and forth, but also ultimately at the end, under like obviously an Iranian regime that is not caring for them, and more importantly, under an American regime that is sort of exerting itself in very violent ways. And America has been at war with Iran over the past 41 years. And I think that Iranians right now are living like it's wartime. And I think that that's why it's absolutely important that one thing that we're seeing about COVID is that it's not just a disease that's hitting everybody equally or a virus. It literally is showing the inequalities of the systems that we live in very clearly. And one thing that we're realizing is that America has been at war with Iran. And I think that this is being able to be illuminated in the ways in which the injustice of the sort of chokehold that America has in Iran is also coming to light in this moment in the very like most cruel and inhuman way. And so I think the international community, for a country like the UK even to like come and ask the United States to lift sanctions, I think it's something that is really unprecedented. I think something that is important though is that there has been precedent for the United States lifting sanctions during major humanitarian crisis. So once in 2003, the Bam earthquake in Iran under Bush, sanctions were temporarily lifted when 38,000 Iranians were killed, and again once under Obama when there was another major earthquake in Iran. So there is precedent for lifting sanctions, but I think this current regime sort of is unprecedented in many ways. So I think we're all sort of figuring out what the response or how we can push the current situation to be able to think about the ways in which we're trying to recraft the world in a way that works for everybody and not just people living domestically here. We have actually seen China ship a lot of medical supplies to Iran, and I think that there's something to be said about the ways in which this is almost pushing and like how this will have like effects for years and decades to come, and the ways in which America is constantly failing in terms of its lack of leadership, and the world is sort of looking at America and China on these two ends of one that's sort of putting a chokehold on the world, and China coming to try to like continuously send planes of hospital beds and equipment and things like that. So I think that's really important to note. Right now for the campaign, I think what's just so difficult is that sanctions feel so theoretical and feel so intangible. We don't have like a local sanctions office in all of our cities that we can just kind of go and protest to. Also, so we can't go and protest physically. So I think right now, what's really important for organizers is figuring out how we can use this moment in a truly intersectional way to think about how we can creatively protest people and bring people to light who have always been behind the scenes. People like Steven Mnuchin, who is the Secretary of Treasury, and all of everyone who's sort of wrapped up in the operations of this. Being able to like talk about, again, like the sort of the global relationships of our health here to people around the world and why it's absolutely important that we're working on lifting sanctions so people can fight COVID, because our health care also depends on it. And that allows us to also think about different ways that people are responding. I think one thing also important to note is that like Iran has released almost half of its inmate population in order to sort of contain the spread of the virus, whereas in the United States, we're seeing at Rikers just a spike in the number of people who are infected, and they're definitely
Huda, I think the past 20 or 15 seconds, because you got cut off, I think either because of the internet or the sheer speed at which you are sharing. So can you repeat the bit?
Just about with the inmates.
Can you repeat the bit about the Iranian inmates, both in the U.S. Yes. and the United States?
From ASM Performing Arts Acting School, you're listening to the hottest station, CKUT.